It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The impeachment trial of President Donald Trump began this week. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Democrats have been laying out their case against the president. Article 1 involves abuse of power, in which they charge the president with pressuring Ukraine to announce investigations into the DNC surfer hack of the 2016 election and a probe into Trump's strongest Democratic rival in 2020, which is, of course, former Vice President Joe Biden. Article 2 charges the president with obstruction of Congress with his denials of witnesses and documents during the House impeachment investigation. Take a look at this initial week of this impeachment, historic impeachment, I guess one would say. We have in our studio this morning Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at Salisbury University. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So, well, first of all, I've been trying to watch most of it. I have to take a break every once in a while. But what do you make of the Democrats' presentation in terms of its coherence? And is it, I think it was Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham said, but maybe they're just, they may be over-arguing their case.
Well, I think the strategy for the Democrats is really twofold. I mean, the two scenarios that they face, their most optimistic one, of course, is that they can somehow persuade sufficient Republicans to break ranks and vote not only to bring in witnesses and documents, but perhaps the bridge that they'd love to cross would be, of course, a dismissal from office, that is, removal to get a vote to convict Donald Trump. But I think most of them are realistic about that possibility as being out beyond the pale. Really, their second scenario that they're really working at, I think, is that they are trying to make the case, particularly to the American public. They are trying to really detail, lay out as much evidence as they possibly can to convince Americans, American citizens watching the trial, that Donald Trump is indeed guilty of the alleged crimes to be committed and should be removed from office, in the hopes that come the election in the fall, Trump will in fact be defeated. I mean, I think that we should understand that even though Republicans say, well, they're repetitive and they're going to all this detail, the purpose really is to try to convince Americans, the American public watching, that Donald Trump is indeed convicted and should be removed from office.
If I was reminded, by the way, as I was watching the other night, is I think it wrapped at about 10:30 or so, I think, last night, but there's only like 7:30 on the West Coast. So going long and doing these kinds of things, I think both—
This is also true.
Hits all the markets.
I agree, because they have to deal with the rules that the Republicans have laid down, long days, and of course— Yeah, Mitch McConnell's first ploy was to try to make it a two-day presentation, but he lost on that, interestingly, so that the Democrats indeed have 3 days to lay out this case. And we'll see. Well, it seems clear that some public opinions show that they have moved the dial just a bit, at least with regard to calling for witnesses and documents. I mean, I think that's going to be the interesting thing that will happen coming next week, and that is, to what extent will there be sufficient moderate Republicans who are up for re-election, who are watching the ticker in terms of their own constituencies, if there's some real movement there that their constituencies want witnesses and say, yeah, we'd like to, we think it makes sense to have witnesses, we think it makes sense to have documents called for by the Senate, and perhaps that will open the door for that. But that remains to be seen, I think.
We, of course, have the public opinion polls say something about 70% of Americans think that they should call witnesses.
Yes.
Do you think that's going to be enough for moderate Republicans or Republicans in general who might be on the edge? We talk a little bit about them later. Yes. So that they can say, we voted for witnesses, but we voted not to convict.
I think, again, this is where micro-marketing is going to be the key, right? They're taking the measure of their own states, their own state constituencies. So to my knowledge, at least, the polls that we're looking at are national polls. And the question becomes whether that is reflective in the particular states for, say, Susan Collins in Maine. are the polls in Maine similar to what's happening in the national poll? If that's the case, if indeed it has moved 70% in Maine, which I don't know it has, then Susan Collins may want to consider, if she wants to remain in office, perhaps we need to call witnesses and at least a few witnesses. And again, they could do the same thing they did with the Kavanaugh case. I think parallels have been drawn there. The Republicans, moderate Republicans, felt some heat there, and they moved to say, yes, we'll include some witnesses. We'll include some FBI investigation, if you recall, but no further. They didn't demand. They didn't really go all the way. And here, I think that they'll probably try that as well, and that may very well work. Again, unless the dial really shows that the opinion polls have changed significantly with regard to removal from office of the presidency. People have to remember, all of these people are politicians. They like being politicians. They like remaining in power. And they will, if they see that Trump becomes an albatross around their necks, they'll toss him over. But at this point, that seems clearly not in the cards right now.
So in terms of witnesses, obviously we have people like John Bolton, amongst others, who they want to call, as well as Mick Mulvaney, the acting White House chief of staff. So if, for instance, the senators decide that they want to say, for instance, subpoena, say, Mick Mulvaney, and the president says no, or if the moderate Republicans say they want to do this, but the White House says, well, we're not going to provide it, which puts the moderates certainly in a box. I mean, and this goes really to the heart of something we were talking about before the show, which is that if the president decides not to offer up a witness and there's not the two-thirds to remove, then there's no reason for him to do anything, right? There's this gridlock that continues on.
That's the poker game that will be played. I think you've put your finger on a very important point, and that's correct. What we have been witnessing in part is, I think, step by step, the emergence of a more authoritarian dimension of this particular president and this particular presidency. And the Republicans, in effect, I think someone like Mitch McConnell, he's a good poker player. And he thinks that he can contain this. He thinks that he can maintain kind of control. But what you're identifying is the possibility that they really are losing control of this particular president. Because what are they to do at that point in time? If what is driving their strategy is their fear of Trump's ability to influence their constituency that they need to get reelected, would they fold under that situation? Would they, in fact, say, if the White House really insists no documents, no witnesses at all, okay, will they then back down? Now, whether or not we would see that publicly is an interesting question. But privately, behind scenes, Mitch McConnell might, in fact, back down. And the moderate Republicans, are they really in a position where they could resist that and push, say, no, we're going to really jump ship with the Democrats?
I mean, that would create a crisis if, for instance, the moderates say, for instance, you got the 51 to say, subpoena, for instance, Mick Mulvaney, and the president said no. I mean, that would create a crisis for Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, who certainly wants to avoid that.
Absolutely. And what would be the ability to, what would be the option open to them? Would they then take that to court? Would they try to dump it into the court somehow to push, to force Mulvaney to testify? And if they did that, what does that do to the trial? It lengthens the trial. What does that do? That worsens the situation for Trump. Right? So the dynamic here, no one is in control, really, of the dynamic. Okay, they have influence, the ability to try to influence it. But the card, if Trump would somehow play that card, his advisors would have to anticipate that would lengthen the trial, most likely. Okay? Unless they're confident that McConnell would fold, basically, and back off and say, right. I think that scenario that you're laying out there really also tells us that the most likely situation is they will not call witnesses, because once they open that can of worms, no one knows for sure where that might take it all. Because no one knows at this point. I mean, everyone anticipates, okay? I mean, the Democrats believe that Mulvaney will simply confirm all of the evidence that they've accumulated before, but they don't know that for sure. And the Republicans are fearful that, in fact, that he would do exactly that. But they don't know that for sure either. And if there's a quid pro quo in terms of witness to witness, right, would you get a Biden or Hunter Biden involved in there? Because that's the next ploy here. And there's some discussion really within the Democrats as to whether or not they go for that if they could be confident that Mulvaney would do what they anticipate. But again, as I say, this is... no one controls fully the dynamics that one option or another would open up in the process.
Because, I mean, the minority leader, Schumer, has said that that kind of hostage taking or exchange, yes, as it were, is off the table. Former Vice President Joe Biden on the campaign trail said, no, we're not showing up for this thing. Is such a deal, is that even viable, or can the Democrats, is it so advantageous for them, for instance, to get John Bolton that they would say, fine, you can have Hunter Biden? I mean, is Bolton so significant that that they would hope would either seal the deal or certainly push their argument forward?
I don't know.
Because Bolton says he's going to write a book, which is going to be,
yes,
which is going to lay out a lot of what he thought anyway, yes, later in the campaign.
Yeah. Without inside information, we don't
right.
know, right? But I think we can speculate with reasonable confidence that one reason why the Democrats are resisting that is on the fundamental ethics of it. This is about Donald Trump. This is not about Hunter Biden or Joe Biden. And there's no evidence to indicate, in fact, all the evidence that we have in hand indicates that the Joe Biden's operations as vice president were entirely in sync with American foreign policy, were supported by allies, right? and that Hunter Biden's operation with Burisma, there's no indication of corruption. There's no indication that in fact anything, neither the father or the son had done anything wrong. So putting that aside, it's not relevant to the allegations of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress that Trump. So on that score, clearly they don't need to budge. The second point, of course, is to do the hostage taking, to do the quid pro quo in terms of witnesses, would give some credibility and legitimacy to this bogus argument that the Republicans are making with regard to Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, and do precisely what, in fact, what they would do essentially is allow for Trump to claim a victory, because all he wanted was simply a public discussion of these folks, and he would get that in the trial. He wanted that, of course, for the Ukraine government to do that, but a second best would be for the Senate to actually raise some credibility and legitimacy to that. So that's part of the problem I think Democrats face.
Well, as a matter of fact, Jerry Nadler, who was chair of the Judiciary Committee, he suggested that an acquittal is not an acquittal, it's a cover-up. Now, obviously, that created a lot of backlash. But if I look at the politics down the road... the president can say, I've been acquitted, but I can see the Democrats countering by saying, well, no, this is the cover-up is still going on, and could be accompanied as the campaign moves forward with further revelations. I mean, just because the Senate trial ends doesn't mean the revelations are going to end.
No. This is... this is on the other side. I mean, the Republicans face the problem of the public relations dimension to the trial. If in the public eye, when all is said and done, when the dust settles, if in the public eye the conclusion is You know what? They didn't hold a trial at all. There were no witnesses. They didn't call documents. There was plenty. I mean, there was the Democrats presented a lot of evidence, a lot of, you know, sound argument here, and the Republicans did nothing. They held this so-called trial was quite short and the like. So, you know, there really was, he's not acquitted at all, right? That there's really impeachment, the argument for impeachment and removal from office remains credible, right? So what Trump was hoping for, of course, and what the Republicans would hope for is that an acquittal in the Senate would be seen as a legitimate judgment on the impeachment presented by the House of Representatives. And to be able to frame that is it was simply a partisan act to try to get rid of this president. But they may lose that public relations, that public view of what the trial was all about.
I mean, it does seem to me that this thing's going to plague the president beyond whatever the Senate does.
I absolutely agree. I'm reminded of
Hillary Clinton with the emails and that sort of thing, where people, you know, things would sort of slowly come out and then the FBI would say things and so on. So, I mean, it kept on burning all the way through. I don't see this thing going out before the election.
I completely agree. I think that where this may be going is that the Republicans may have underestimated the impact of impeachment itself, because if the Democrats are able to make the case that this president was impeached and the trial was a sham, there is this acquittal is a fraud. Right? I mean, the language just flows, right? I mean,
right.
It's not difficult. As we work here, you can only imagine what the Democrats are going to be able to put forth in terms of the language, the argument, if in fact Republicans. So again, that's the pressure on the Republicans is whether, I mean, if they have some witnesses and have documents, you know, then that helps. Even if it's all, you know, essentially show and that they're really not seriously considering removal, that helps to make the trial a more legitimate process. But we'll have to see.
I mean, sometimes I wonder whether or not it may wind up, McConnell may wind up with a Pyrrhic victory.
Correct, exactly.
He wins the acquittal, but in the end, It may backfire. I mean, as you suggest. Well, let's turn to the Republicans here and the president's defense team. So, what did you make? I mean, the only thing we've really seen so far really is the haggling over the rules in the first go round, and so we seem to get some glimpse of what the president's arguments are going to be. One thing that struck me was, at least in that forum, they didn't seem very coherent. But then again, you know, they're going to get a long stretch of time in which they'll be able to lay it out, as Democrats have. What do you make of the kinds of arguments, first of all, that the defense team is making?
It's rather thin, it seems. They seem to be pursuing at least two lines of argument, and which I think we'll perhaps see in a more, perhaps more detail, but perhaps not when they actually get their 3 days. One is the one that says, well, this is all hearsay evidence. And how can you convict a president? How can you remove a president when you only have hearsay evidence and not any inside evidence that really comes from the president? I mean, and the evidence that we can present, like Trump saying, and I don't want quid pro quo, right, shows that the president has articulated against precisely what you're trying to say he's doing. Now, the problem, of course, with that particular argument is that it shows anyone thinking closely about that, it's hypocrisy, because the reason why you don't have inside information is because the president won't allow those who would be in those discussions to testify. And the documents that would be necessary to corroborate the evidence to actually be brought forth. So I think they face a problem there, but I think they're going to do that anyway, right? Because, again, we have to remember, who are they speaking to? They're principally speaking to the base of the Republican Party and some independents who aren't watching very closely, right? So they think they can thread that needle, I think. The second and perhaps the more important argument, I think, and this is where I think many Republicans are, like Lindsey Graham, and that is, so what, right? This people do this all the time, as Mulvaney said publicly. Presidents have to operate in different ways diplomatically. Article 2 powers give presidents the power to be the chief diplomat, right? And you know, maybe he went a little bit overboard, right? And they, you know, we can scold him a little bit, but this is not a big deal. The money was finally released in any case, so there isn't any genuine obstruction of congressional will, right? So it does not rise to the fundamental abuse of power which would trigger removal from office, and therefore acquittal is the most reasonable thing to do.
What about Alan Dershowitz's argument, which is that the president needs to have committed some kind of violation of law, that it's not enough simply to say that it was an abuse of power?
Okay. Well, first of all, of course, Dershowitz contradicts himself, because he said
years ago, he said
you don't have to, right? So, well, but put that aside for the moment. Let's take a look at the actual argument here. I think that the illogic of that and the falsehood of that assertion, that kind of claim, lies in part on the fact that the fundamental law of the land is not statutory law, but the Constitution itself. So abuse of powers is literally in the Constitution, in the impeachment power. So if you can make the case that, in fact, a president has abused power, right? And, of course, the Democrats, in one way of their doing that, is saying it's abusive power to get a foreign power to interfere in the fundamental elections of democracy for the United States. That is prima facie a case of abuse of power and is a violation of the law. So Dershowitz seems to want to argue that the Constitution isn't the law.
His argument, first of all, in the Constitution itself, they're simply talking about treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors, right? So they don't in and of itself use those words, right? So they don't use those words. But Dershowitz is also making another argument, which is that other high crimes and misdemeanors are somehow tied to treason and bribery. That somehow they're a reflection of. Now, and I think one could make an argument that bribery very well could be involved here because of the quid pro quo that. Obviously, the president says he wasn't, but nonetheless, face. Yeah.
It's pretty clear that the high crimes and misdemeanors, the abuse of power, when you look at the Federalist Papers, when you look at what the framers, how they interpreted that, right? Abuse of power was clearly one of the dimensions of that, right? So
they talk about public trust, right?
Public trust.
Hamilton's 65.
Right. Yeah, so the most reasonable interpretation of the particular language within the Constitution is to entail abuse of power as a reasonable violation of the Constitution. Right? And the other piece that I would all add as well is that if we look at the relationship of the institutions within the government itself, it is only the Congress that has the ability, the authority, to remove presidents and executive officers. It's only Congress that has the ability to remove Supreme Court justices and judges within the judiciary. Presidents cannot remove members of Congress. The Supreme Court cannot remove members of Congress. It is a one-way street, and we have to try to understand why that's the case. And I think the answer to that is that the framers drew from the philosophers and the theorists of government that they drew from, particularly, were folks like Montesquieu and particularly Locke. I mean, we can understand our structure as a fundamentally comes out of a Lockean, essentially the second treatise on government, where Locke emphasizes the supreme power should lie within the legislature, within the Congress, as a translation here. But there was always a fear that the executive would assume power, that there was always going to be possibility of a drift towards executive power, that the accumulation of power would occur there. Hence, the impeachment power is meant as a fundamental check on the executive. Hence, I think the more plausible interpretation, contra to Dershowitz, is, and this is where I think Lawrence Tribe, one of the folks that makes this argument, is on more sound ground than Dershowitz with regard to that abuse of power is justifiably a dimension that one can impeach a president.
And it is true that when you look at that phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors, you're really talking about not crimes that we think of, that is, it's stealing or bribery or whatever, but rather crimes against the crown in England and obviously against the president here. Finally, I gave you a little homework assignment, which is if you were making a defense argument in the last couple of minutes we have left for the president, how would you argue in his defense?
What has emerged for conservatives more recently, and really comes out of people like Dick Cheney and the Bush administration, is what's called the unitary theory of the president. And basically that theory argues that, contrary to essentially the Madisonian view, Article 2 does in fact entail or implies sufficient powers to the presidency, particularly the commander-in-chief power, but also the power of the chief diplomatic power. And hence, you can defend Trump's dealings with Ukraine as that's simply an expanded ability to conduct foreign policy. Their emphasis will be he was really interested in corruption more generally within the Ukraine, and the Bidens were simply a particular case. And if you have problems with that, well, okay, we can have some reasonable discussion about that. But there was no violation of any kind of norm of presidential power. There was no abuse of power here. So it does not rise to the criteria, the threshold necessary to remove a president from power.
We've been speaking with Professor Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at Salisbury University, and obviously seen just the first glimpse of the impeachment trial. We're going to have you back along with some other folks after it's over on the 7th. Take a look at what comes out, and indeed, at that point, we'll also have, of course, the State of the Union. So it'll be an interesting performance, as it were, by the president amidst all of this other stuff. And we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Yes, anytime.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. The War Museum is celebrating the 50th annual World Championship Wildfowl Carving Competition and Art Festival. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The museum is named after the Eastern Shore's most famous decoy carvers, the Ward brothers, Stephen and Lem. And it has seen not only a variety of carvings, but also development of many of the craft's men and women. In celebration, museum's LeMay Gallery will feature some of the best winning pieces. And in our studio this morning is Dominic Tartaglia. He is curator and folklorist for the museum. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, well, first of all, tell me then, are you a relative new arrival at the museum? How long have you been there?
Yeah, I got there September.
Okay.
Yeah, I just finished my PhD and came out to work in a museum, in the museum, and... yeah, so it's been like a season here on the Eastern Shore.
So, from your own perspective, what got you into being a folklorist? What drove your passion here?
I think I'd always been interested in sort of the material culture and like the human side of art, folklore. Always attracted me as like because like the personal relationship you get to have with the artists and like the communities, sort of like that like a personal relation to the study of art. You know what I mean? That's kind of how I got to it. You know, it was like archaeology. Everyone's been long dead. Like mythology. You're dealing with stories rather than dealing with people. I wanted to find something where I could like study like culture and like be having face-to-face conversations with people all the time.
So have you been involved with looking at particularly at the decoys, which is this particular history that we have at the Ward?
Yeah, I mean, like, believe it or not, out in Indiana where I was, like, we know the Ward brothers. Like, when I taught, like, animal folklore, there was, like, a whole day on decoys. And, like, it's funny going to the museum and, like, seeing pieces. Like, I can remember, like, a particular, like, Victor Peroyan blue-winged teal that's at the museum. I'm like, I'd put that in a PowerPoint slide. Like, I totally recognize this one. So this is it's a world championship. This is, like, world famous art that is, like, that is out here on the Eastern Shore that people know about in circles all across the nation. If it's got to Southern Indiana, it's got places. I'll say that.
So tell me a little bit about what impresses you, particularly with the Ward brothers and some of their history.
The Ward brothers, I think it's just the it's the details. It's the little things, particularly about the Ward brothers, how like little advancements, little ways that they moved the needle that just ended up being these big paradigm shifts in the art form. Like you look at just like how they were pulling feathers, like how they were just doing like the little brush strokes to paint feathers. And then like after them, putting feathers on the decoys becomes this like whole like art form. There's this whole like explosion in that in the technique. You know what I mean? That starts off just with little innovations they make that ends up just advancing everything rapidly afterward. Or you look at like the way they would do like you know you can always tell like a Ward duck the way like the head is kind of cocked. You know, that kind of like lifelike like emotion on the decoy, the way the head is moving, the way the eyes look. It's just a little thing that ends up like snowballing into this big paradigm shift years later. I think that's what impresses me, particularly about the Ward brothers themselves and their art.
Because at the Ward Museum, by the way, you have a number of like working decoys, mm-hmm. but then you get a transition out. Explain this transition that takes place from, on the one hand, they were like pouring these things out in between cutting hair, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. But then after a while, it became an art form.
Yeah. After a while, we get into this sort of like what we call like interpretive art. You get all of these carvings that are like the statuesque that have a sort of... Oh, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a sort of high art sensibility to like this like folk art genre, you know. Right now, as you mentioned, in our 50th anniversary exhibit in the LeMay Gallery right now, we've got some of the stuff like when you get to like the 2010s, we've got like a ruddy duck that looks like it's like a cubist ruddy duck. You have like a frigate bird that like looks like a World War II bomber in the wings. It's got like that like a like the guts of an airplane and the wings, you know. You've got like just like a burl that has like a wood, like a baby wood duck like emerging out of it. Emerging is a good word for like all of this, you know. There's like this emergent quality of like a sort of like a high art sensibility to a folk art tradition. I think that's certainly part of the legacy of the Ward Brothers, bring like the sensibility of fine art to this like a community based tradition of decoy carving. But at the same time, like all of those decoys that that were like working decoys in like the, you know, the 40s and 50s and 60s between cut and hair that they were doing, I mean, like that there is certainly like an art form to that. I mean, like if you really think about it, like the most lifelike thing, the most like realistic thing a decoy does, it floats. Like, can you just like I know like that's kind of like that's the baseline, that's the given, like, oh yeah, that like it's got to float. But even that is like an entire that's like a huge revolutionary achievement, you know what I mean? That like something that like your art can also have this functionality at the same time, and it's always been that. It's been this like reflection of like the culture and the environment. I mean, that's huge just on decoy carving as an art form.
What do you make, by the way? I mean, I've interviewed several of the of those who carve, and generally speaking, and this is my own impression coming from outside the areas, they're very Eastern Shore. There are a lot of older guys. For instance, I know Rich Smoker, for example, who's involved with your museum. These are not people who you would have think of as being artists.
Yeah, and they're certainly not artists in like the institutional sense. I don't think you can say artists without like tipping your nose right, forward yeah, anymore. Exactly. But it really is to show how art exists in communities, how art exists like in our everyday life. I mean, people are artistic in their everyday life, and there's like certain like ways they reflect it. Especially like the ways these everyday artistic abilities are invested in their community. I think like you think the Eastern Shore and you think like, okay, decoys, that is like an artistic, like a living artistic tradition that is like invested and reflected in like the life ways of this region. And I mean, just because like you don't learn decoy carving at like an art academy, like I think doesn't mean it's any less artistic or doesn't mean it's any less important. And I think that's the Ward Museum in a, it's a big part of the Ward Museum, I should say, is that we're really celebrating the like a specific kind of everyday artistic ability, like this specific kind of artistic tradition that's very invested in our community out here. These people might not call themselves like capital A artists, but they do have, they have talent and they have like an investment in their art form, and they have the chops.
Are you surprised that seemingly ordinary people, I'm going to say completely ordinary, but that they become really deeply involved in this, and over a period of years? I mean, there's some of them who like start carving when they're younger, but others in middle age, they gravitate to this.
It's one of those things. Like I'm surprised. I'm pleasantly surprised every day. It's not like I expect these people to, you know, like you're saying, like ordinary people mm-hmm. to like not have this artistic side. But like everyone's got that in their own way. And I just love like working with these people, run across these people who all have that. So like I'm used to it. Can you be used to something and still get like a happy, pleasant surprise every time you see it? That's probably where I'm at. It's like it's a wonderful part of everyday life that we like to celebrate.
The big question is, have you ever tried to carve one of these things?
Oh, my God. I mean, like, just that's the thing about working in a museum. Just don't look at the cuts on my hand. I'm not... In the past, I've painted, but I, you know, one day I'll get to start carving this with the proper safety precautions, because I will be a klutz and I will nick my own finger. I already know it.
So when they go to the museum, what kinds of things are we going to be seeing in your celebration? First of all,
oof, we've got a whole range of carvings from 1971, the first year that we had the competition, back when it was still in Salisbury. All the way up to the most recent piece is in that exhibit is 2018. There's like the current 2019 winners are on display elsewhere in the gallery until March. And then, you know, of course, April, we crown the new ones. So this retrospective exhibit for the 50th annual goes from 71 to 2018. You'll see all kinds of things. You'll see, like, 1971, you'll see, like, the first world champion pair. You'll see the first miniature to ever be world champion. But you'll see, beyond that, you'll see all types of things. You'll see various interpretive pieces that, you know, have this like your sense of detail and like this like this like grand scope really it's like they're imaginative. These are like imaginative interpretive pieces like the ones I mentioned earlier. You'll see all types of miniatures, you'll see natural finish, you'll see beautiful paintings, you'll see like entire family history, like three winners in one family in this one gallery, like at this exhibit, you know.
What were those like? What were those?
The first one we've got a first one is a pair of canvas backs that won in 1981. That is Tan Brunet from Galliano, Louisiana, who just recently passed in 2019. His two sons later, one in the 80s, one in the 90s, both won four pairs. One of his sons did Ruddy Ducks that were world champions, and one of his sons did Ringneck Ducks.
What are those?
Ringneck Ducks are... we get some ringneck ducks, I think, every now and then on Shoemaker Von, actually. I think we do every now and then. Kind of like they've got like a stripe, like the head is like a black, and then they've got like a like stripe here, and then the body goes down like another color. They have this like this band around, like, you know, where like the beak sits down. Mm-hmm. So he did a pair of those, I believe, in like the early 90s. That's three winners in one family. We've got them all in the LeMay Gallery, in the Brunet family from Louisiana. Pat Godden, who's a very accomplished champion, we have his Barrow's Golden Eyes that he carved in 2016. I believe his first world championship was 1976, and we have his 2016 ones. It's just kind of like the long legacy of his storied career. We've got Lynn Branson, the only female world champion. We've got one of her interpretive pieces there that I want to say it's like one of the only ones that's in, I mean, she's Canadian, but it's one of the only ones that's in America and we have on loan for this exhibit. Getting pieces from Canada is kind of difficult, but we have, I want to say, 27 winners in this new exhibit in the gallery right now.
So, you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? My favorite is the one I alluded to earlier, is that Frigate Bird, Anatomy of Flight by Jeff Crete, who's he's an Ontarian himself. It starts off, imagine going from left to right, okay, on this Frigate Bird. Wings out, okay? You're looking at it on your left, and its feathers, it goes to about like the median of the bird's body, where like there's like a varnish, and you can see like a steel sighting on the side of its head, and then the entire what is your right side of the bird I believe it's a DC-10. It's all like an older plane. It looks like the schematics of a plane, trying to draw this connection to flight in nature and then flight in technology, like how our technology relates to the natural world, like the way birds have figured out flight, we have figured out flight. I think it's like a profound statement on on not just like, you know, there's like this technological statement about how like humans build planes and how like nature builds birds. But I also think it's this like artistic statement about how like when humans build aircraft, we are really like making our own kind of art. Reflecting the way that like wings work in nature, you know, it's like a function and like a functionality and aesthetics thing. The way that we take in the natural world and make it like functional for us, it's this really profound piece. I know I'm talking about a frigate bird, which is kind of like a funny looking bird, you know, but it's you know, you just your eye scales across the whole width of this piece, and you're thinking about you're thinking about aircraft and the way the shadow hits it, and it's this dramatic silhouette that looks like a bomber on the back of the wall, and there's steel and feathers, and it's wooden, the base is aluminum. It's just this dramatic piece that's everything like philosophical that I love about art wrapped up in one piece.
Was there any technique or any piece in the exhibit that surprised you? I mean, obviously you liked it, but anything particularly? I mean, at one point I remember, and I don't know if you still have this, but I remember in the museum there used to be one small exhibit in which they compared a real feather to a one that's been carved. I don't know if you still have that or not, but is there any piece that surprised you in terms of the kind of detail that they produce?
Some of the feathering, having to like touch them and put them under the case. Yeah, exactly. Like some of the detail on the feathers blows my mind. That like you look at this and you're just thinking like, oh, is this wood? I can't believe it. The big one that surprised me, having to like to deal with it in person, having to like get it on loan, put it under the case, is this great aigrette carved by Gary Eigenberger, a multiple world champion, that we have in the new exhibit. You look at this thing and it's about like it's 2 feet tall in total from like base to like the beak of this bird, and here you have like a kind of about like a foot or like 8-inch long bird kind of on an angle on a reed, and the reed comes out of this base and you look at it and you're like, there is no way that reed is not going to snap. That reed looks like, if that, like, there's two things that are going on here, like when you look at it, two things that could possibly happen. A, that bird is actually going to take off, or B, that reed is going to snap, and neither happens. It's right in this state of, like, the reed that he carved is bending, and the bird is just effortlessly sitting on the edge, on just the precipice of taking flight, and it's just like this, it's like a snapshot of this just, you know, little sublime moment in nature. And someone carved that. Someone carved that with like very thin wood and like captured this moment in time. And I think that's like a little, you know, part of the detail, just both like structurally and artistically. Like in order for all those things to come together, for this artist to capture that moment is a ton of details.
Because one of the things that strikes me, as you're talking, is that it, in many ways, and I've seen some of these in the exhibit, is that the carvings are such that they're almost like a photograph, in the sense that a photograph takes just one instant, right? Just a moment in time, which everything is like in the photograph. It sounds like the carvers have basically done the same thing. It's just one single moment, as if they've frozen something in time.
Yeah. I think all my favorite ones are certainly like that. Like this little, almost like a unit of time. You can see just like this is just like one piece of this, this hypothetical bird's life. And then you really pull yourself back and be like, that was a block of wood before he started carving and painting it. But we come to experience it as like this like, you know, this document, this like a, this like moment where we have such like imagination. This is like this whole experience in our imagination looking at it.
So we have a number of people obviously who are participating, who are carving. Do you see this particular art form increasing in terms of popularity, or particularly in terms of participation, people actually becoming involved in carving? Where do you see that arc in terms of decoy carving?
I mean, you just you mentioned earlier Rich Smoker. I mean, I feel like because he's chairman of the board of directors, I have to brag on behalf of him right. that he's a National Endowment of the Arts fellow this right. year. I mean, that's huge. There's like what, 5 or 6 artists in the United States who get an NEA fellowship as like, not just like, yeah, his contributions to carving, but it's his contributions to like the life of the arts in America. I mean, that's a huge thing. I mean, we can look at that as like, okay, so we got like the hardware, you know, this art form has like the hardware. They've got an NEA fellow, you know, you see, every people come out to Worlds, people who come out to, you know, let's say like Easton, the Waffle Festival up in Easton, you know what I mean? All of that, there's I see people of all ages going out there. But I think the way you judge wildfowl carving, decoy carving, really like folk art in general, is the communities, you know? You go on that like that local scale. The local communities thrive. Do the local communities sustain this? Is the tradition being passed down, passed along, you know? And I think especially coming out here, you know, from the Midwest. And I mean, there's decoy carving in like the upper Midwest, but like mm-hmm. kind of in southern Indiana, there's a little less. And coming out here, like my big impression from the Eastern Shore is like, yeah, this is a community. This is a tradition that is being like sustained and is alive in its local communities of practice.
How important do you think these kinds of art forms are? I mean, obviously we have decoy carving here on the shore, and obviously they have other things in other places of the country. How important do you think that is in particularly maintaining a community's identity?
Oh, can I say the most important? I mean, like community identity one, yeah, because like everyone's going to have their own little take. Everyone's going to have their own variations. It'll all be like a part of the big conversation about, you know, about art or about tradition. But every little community is going to have like their own little special way of expressing it, their own little take on it. You know, at Worlds, for example, like Ontario and Louisiana are rivals in decoy carving, like a very friendly rivalry, but like, How different can two regions be? Right. You know, how different can Toronto and New Orleans be? I think that's like the fact that they both have like their own like unique identities, unique like legacies, and unique like sensibilities. But I think as we were talking earlier, like these people, you know, decoy carvers, they are artists. They use their hands, they use their imaginations, they use their hearts, and they put that all out there into the art they make. And I think like what these like community arts are really good at doing is just like keeping art an everyday thing instead of just like an institutional thing, instead of being like exclusively a high art form. I think art is an everyday thing. Art is a thing in all of our lives. And I think the art situated like this in a community helps keep art recognizable in our everyday lives.
So we're going to have, obviously you're celebrating this 50th annual carving competition, but obviously then there's going to be a competition. What should we expect about that? And I guess it's going to be in Ocean City as usual, right?
Yeah, Ocean City Convention Center. What do we expect from usual? So every Friday at Worlds, we have the Living Legends, the award presentation, the Ward Museum crowns like the Living Legends of the art of decoy carving. I will say, pulling out all the stops for Living Legends of the 50th. To be a living legend, honored at the 50th, of course, is a huge deal. Nice round number, big anniversary. So there's going to be a lot of fanfare for that. I think, in general, it'll be sort of, I kind of see this as like a family reunion of like the extended family of carvers from, you know, across America, across North America, the world, if I should be so bold. Because I think, you, like you said, 50th annual, it's a huge anniversary. It's a huge milestone. I think a lot of people are coming back for it. A lot of people want to be there in person to celebrate this big accomplishment and this big enduring legacy of the Ward Brothers this year. So I think the word I'd say for the 50th annual Worlds is it's a milestone. It's a celebration.
And now you expect not obviously only the folks who are local here, but in the States, but you're also expecting people from outside the country to be participating. I mean, even beyond, say, Canada.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a big Japanese contingent every year. I was asking some people, like, what is your favorite at the opening for the exhibit? I was asking people, what's your favorite piece that, like, had never won world championship? And I think the answer I heard a lot from people, they just said, what was the name of the giant Russian eagle? They kept saying giant Russian eagle. How did that guy bring that eagle from Russia? So like, could we have another story? Like, do you remember that one year we saw the giant Russian eagle? That is to say, people come from the other side of the world with these just feats of art and imagination, and they come to Ocean City, Maryland with these fruits of their hands and their hearts and their sweat.
How many competitors do you expect to see? I mean, any sense about that? Or
I don't have that offhand. Okay. I don't have that offhand, but I can tell you, 27 pieces in the gallery.
Well, right, and you're going to get a lot more. I mean,
my God, yeah.
And of course, it's going to be held at the. By the way, are you guys at the convention itself? Are you going to be doing anything special, or I mean, is there going to be presentations or anything?
I will say Thursday evening at the Art League of Ocean City. Mm-hmm. There's the Artist After Hours, which all the artists like mingle with each other. People see all their favorite artists. It's like a casual thing. It's not like, you know, sitting there getting judged or anything. It's just seeing all of your friends again, seeing all like your favorite artists. And the other big fun thing at Worlds, of course, is the auction just Saturday afternoon, which is like how some of these story pieces, some of these big pieces like move across the country, get bought and sold, go elsewhere. But for a lot of people, I think it's just exciting to see what is at Worlds and what is going to what's like on the pulse of bird carving, of this art form. We have some the War Museum is going to be supplying some pretty impressive carvings this year at the auction. I don't think I can say any more about it right now, but it's going to some real milestone worthy things are going to be the auction this year. I will say that. And Living Legends, which I already mentioned, which is, you know, an honor and a milestone in itself.
We've been speaking with Dominic Tartaglia. He is the curator and folklorist at the War Museum, and talking about the 50th anniversary of the World Championship Wildfowl Carving Competition and Art Festival, which will take place at the Convention Center in Ocean City. We appreciate you stopping to talk with us this morning.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.